today. People asked me what is digital humanities about. Really, I always give basic reasons, which is, well, why don't you just follow Dan Cohen on Twitter, or read Dan Cohen's blog, or listen to the dulcet tones you are about to enjoy Dan Cohen's voice on the Digital Canvas podcast. Hearing Dan speak always takes me back to walking my dogs, to woods behind my house, where I have heard him speak for many hours on Magic Digital. If you didn't already know, Professor Cohen is associate professor of history at Georgia Tech University, as well as director of the recently rechristened the Lori Rosenzweig Center for History and Media. His books include Equations from God, Pure Mathematics, and Foreign Faith, if I have that right, and his co-author, Digital History, a guide to gathering, preserving, and presenting the past on the web. As you've heard this morning, more recently, he supported the Patent Academy, a remarkable outsourced volume of essays related to digital humanities and the university, and there will be a print version of that forthcoming in 2012, the University of Michigan Press. He is currently at work on a book he is calling The Ivory Tower and the Open Web. I'm very excited to be able to welcome Dan Cohen. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that kind of introduction, Chris. You know, it's great to be here at the launch of the Institute. You know, always great to be at UVA, especially on a fall, crisp fall day. It's really nice. I'll try to get us out into the fall weather as quickly as I can. You know, it's also, I think, great and appropriate to be talking about this topic at UVA because I think a lot of what I'm going to talk about today in terms of really the past, present, and the future of the web and the nature of the web itself in many ways was sort of pioneered here in the humanities here at UVA. And I've really taken a lot of inspiration from what's gone on here at IATH and Scholars Lab and Jerry's work. And so, you know, you really deserve a lot of the credit for what I'm going to talk about. I am thinking right now, I've been working on this book and looking back and forward about how humanities scholars, and you'll see I altered the title a little bit at the last minute, not just scholars in the web, but humanities scholars in the web, thinking a little bit about how humanities scholars have used it. I'm going to go over some of that history just a little, very briefly today, specifically talking about the history of humanities scholars blogging and the tools that they use. But I wanted to focus it more on humanities scholars because, you know, it hasn't been a great history. You know, humanities scholars have done many things, but I don't think we've done the web that well outside of this campus and a few others. You know, if we compare our use of the web to, say, the physicists, the history becomes even sadder and sketchier. Now, of course, you know, the web began in the community of physics, and it was physicists who began using it most aggressively early on in places like the Los Alamos National Labs preprint server. Right after the web came out, they already were using the web to exchange scholarly information. That, of course, became archive.org, arxiv.org, which now has over 1 million papers in physics. You know, there are, I don't want to dwell on the lack of use of the web by humanities scholars, but there, you know, things like this where Ithaca does studies of faculty use of digital technologies, and you have graphs like this one of, you know, percent of faculty in different disciplines using a repository for disciplinary work. And you can see here Lit, Classics, all under 10%. Faculty who've actually gone ahead and just, you know, even done something as simple as uploaded a PDF into a repository for papers, compared to over 40% in physics. And this was 2 years ago. I assume that's over 50% now in physics. So, you know, has it been our finest hour? No. I mean, oddly enough, the humanities side of the quad tends to be, you know, the most liberal, progressive side of the quad, and yet in terms of use of new technologies, it has been relatively conservative. And I've just been puzzling about, you know, why that is, and thinking back and looking at some of this history. And I was struck really this morning by Jeremy Boggs bringing up Eric Raymond's Cathedral and the Bazaar, which really jives with what I'm going to say. I mean, I think that there's a basic tension here between the way that a lot of humanities scholars work, which is far more like a cathedral. Perfection, clarity, finishing things first. We don't like the hustle and bustle and the permeable boundaries of the bazaar. There's a lot of attitude here that I think is part of this tension between humanities scholars and the web. So, you know, as much as I've given talks like this, and I gave talks involving a lot of these charts a few weeks ago during Open Access Week, where I suppose the main motivator was shame, and shame can be a very powerful motivator to say, you know, come on, to your colleagues, like, look at this, this is pathetic. You know, I've decided that actually there's a much more powerful character trait that actually exists in surplus in the academy, and that's narcissism. And so I've been trying to focus on ways to frame the web for humanities scholars in a narcissistic fashion, to draw them into the web on the demand side of things. And I want to talk about the kind of supply side of the web and the demand side, the ways in which humanities scholars consume or use the web. And then if we can think about ways to frame the web and explain what the web is so that it plays on our narcissism rather than the shame of, you know, you should be using a 20-year-old technology. Come on, right? So, you know, what is the web? It's more than 20 years old, but I actually think it's still a very valid question. And, you know, a lot of what motivates me is just how really remarkable and unusual it remains. I still think it's a really curious place. I mean, we know that on a technical level, it is merely a set of open protocols and standards that are put on top of another layer of open standards and protocols. It is sitting on, and that is sitting on top of a communications network. I mean, we can technically describe what the web is, but I think that the spirit of the web or the culture of the web is something more important, and that's what I want to focus on. I think by its nature, I think it promotes things naturally that are open and flexible and that link and interrelate and that evolve and iterate. And I want to walk through some of these elements. I think also, as Vince Cerf said about the internet, that it encourages permissionless innovation at the edges, I think is even more true of the web, because it is more of a consumer technology, more of an end-user technology than something like TCP/IP. It can be engaged fairly readily, and it can become an authoring environment fairly readily for even non-technical users. So this notion of permissionless innovation at the fringes, I think, is really important. But of course, you know, all this stuff goes against these deeply held attitudes in the humanities of clear boundaries between works and perfection and, you know, crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's. And that's what really struck me as we were looking at Eric Raymond's piece. So let me walk through some of these points. So openness and standards produce generative platforms. I want to credit this notion of generative platforms I'm really interested in now. You'll see where it comes from, but I want to credit Ed Summers while we're being recorded here, who is a developer at the Library of Congress, for alerting me to this great phrase. And I think it's really a powerful phrase. You know, the web's openness and standards produce generative platforms. That is, they're not static. They continually sort of like a flower bed. They continue to kind of produce new and unusual things in ways that other media don't. They're open. It's open-endedness, I think, is really a fascinating part of the web. You know, rather than a feeling of knowing it all, which is a very academic feeling, right? Especially at the graduate and postgraduate levels of the academy, that we know it all and can kind of crystallize it all. It instead has an attitude of not knowing it all, but enabling a space where new things can be produced. And you'll hear me again and again, I've talked about this in other places and written about this, but you always have to make the assumption on the web that users will have uses for your materials that cannot be anticipated in advance. And that's what the web does really well in its ideal form, is that it enables uses that are not anticipated by the producers of the original content, site, etc. I thought about this just in the last segment of all these great Salem Witch Trial primary source documents. There's an environment there in which to explore it. And yet, because, well, once it goes out of its password-protected space, it will be put into a space where there could be other kinds of uses. Steve could come along and run some text mining on it if the full text was available or the XML is available. He wouldn't have to write a letter or get a letter of recommendation to go and do that. He could begin work on that. The second thing I've been thinking a lot about is that interfaces shape genres. And the web is so good at producing new genres, which is a lot, again, very scary to academia, right? We've got our genres, we know them, we're sticking to them, right? We've got our books, we've got our articles, we know how to write them, they're a certain length, we have all these other formats of the web, and we want to ignore them because it just muddies the waters of what we're doing. But new genres are produced and interfaces shape those new genres. I specifically want to talk about this with respect to blogging and how blogging has changed over the past 20 years and how actually I think it's evolved more toward an academic space, and I'll show you why interface-wise as we walk through that. So here, of course, if you're in command of your own tools, then you can shape the interfaces that shape the genres. If we are reliant on outside corporations or others to shape our interfaces, then we will end up with the genres that they give us. But we can begin to think about new genres and how they might work in the humanities and shape our own destiny through the interfaces. And I mean that in the very broadly construed meaning of the term interface. Finally, communities define practice on the web. Here, I think we should feel great kinship. I mean, what's incredible about academia, I think we're incredibly lucky. I mean, we are a scholarly community that defines our own practice. We wake up in the morning, we write about what we want to write about. We have people who read it and think about it together. And in a sense, we, out of nothing, we create new disciplines, new ideas, we debate them. We get to do that. And on the web as well, communities have a very strong role in defining specific practices. I think just Chris brought up Twitter. And I was a skeptic for a year and a half about Twitter. Tom Scheinfeld, I will credit Tom for finally getting me on the service. I couldn't understand it. It seemed idiotic. It's 140 characters. How could it do anything, right? And yet there was an early community that defined practices, the retweet, right? The at symbol to reference someone, actually, right? All kinds of little things that occurred that made it more of a network of thought, linking out, right? All of these things organically came up through communities of practice. And you can still see this going on Twitter. For instance, there was a big debate over the past week among journalists about whether they should add something, a new kind of retweet called an NT, a neutral tweet, which is a way of, let's say, retweeting a politician's statement on Twitter without it feeling like an endorsement from the New York Times or from a journalist. These tiny little things are examples, I think, of communities of practice that are working within the constraints, but also with the flexibility of the web, and the technologies of the web to make standards and practice that work for their communities. Very, very powerful. Okay, so let me give an example of blogs, which started out as web blogs or link blogs. And you can see the progression here as different communities of practice take on the form, change the interfaces, and make it something new. You know, as Scott Rosenberg has pointed out, you know, this is really the beginning of blogging right here. I don't know if people remember this in the great Mosaic browser, but often the homepage was set to the What's New page at NCSA. And really, this is the first blog, which was a link blog. It was, holy cow, there's this web, you know, there's no search engines yet, so what's out there? How do we find anything? How do we know if a new university has joined the web? So there was this page called What's New at ncsa.illinois.edu, right, that would just have a constant daily updated stream of what's new on the web. And it was really basic. It had that great big gray background in the original browsers. You can actually run the original web interface at, I think it's at dejavu.org, where you can launch these old browsers and browse the web in the early years. So this gives you a good sense of what things look like. And, you know, this had an immense impact, just this one page, I think, in that it shaped for nearly a decade the way people thought about what became blogging, right, which was web logging. It's a log of web links. Here's what's new. Here's what I found. Here's a list. It's in reverse chronological order. Eventually, the calendar was added to the right. All kinds of commercial interests, like Magellan. I don't know if people remember this, which was from the McKinley Group, and eventually became Excite.com. This is like our own little nostalgia machine here. You're excited about it, Excite. Long gone. So the Magellan Internet Guide, this predates Yahoo, but you can see the origins of Yahoo here as well. And they had this feature in the humanities section where they would just have a link blog, and again, reverse chronological order, things that they found. And again, taking on, it's now categorized, but it's the reverse chronological flow of a web log. Here are new sites we found. So I wanted to credit Julia Hayden of Charlottesville, who I wish was here. I don't know if she's actually here. But one of the very first humanities bloggers, web bloggers, she assumed just on her own in 1994 the duty of a curator of ancient history and archaeology. She used the Magellan tools to set up a web blog in 1994. She was also responsible, I think, for the original design of Charlottesville Online. And every day she would scour the web, find things, and update them on this site. She eventually moved to her own site, but you can see again this notion of a set of links that was very powerful. So this is a genre that continued when things like Metafilter in the mid to late 90s and then the original Blogger, which came out of Pyra Labs, and other blogging tools, like, I don't know if anyone had a fondness for Mars Edit. That's that one at the bottom. You can see right here interfaces shaping genres. So what we've got here is, again, the emphasis on title and link. Title and link. Right? The weblog is something that links out to something that's new. Maybe you have one or two lines of commentary on what it is you're linking out to, but it's not a form that enables rich, elaborate scholarship. It is, you know, the text area boxes are really small. They're short little quips. But something was already happening here. Dave Weiner was already thinking about ways to automatically distribute materials that were being put up in these web logs. Some people were already experimenting with writing slightly longer forms into these boxes. And out of this came things like RSS as a distribution method. And these next iteration, when we get to 1999 and 2000, you get iterations here in the top left of the new interface of Blogger and the new interface of Movable Type, where the link box is gone, and all you have now is title and a much larger, I've got a small screenshot here, but a much larger writing box. Right? It has opened up the form. It's no longer a weblog, it's a blog. People start calling them that, and we can begin writing longer forms. We can insert images into it. Yes, you could still link if you want. There's a tiny little link button in their interfaces. But it is still something about, make it what you want. This is when we begin to get diaries, and we also begin to get people like Timothy Burke at Swarthmore writing, you know, what looks to me a lot more like academic work in a blog format. Yes, it's got a date, it's running reverse chronologically, but it is, you know, a title and then long form writing. And Tim would write 1,000 word, 2,000 word posts and put them up on his blog. This is 10 years ago. Kathleen Fitzpatrick, who came up earlier, was part of a community of word herders who began blogging long form 10 years ago using these new tools, Movable Type, frequently, where, again, the emphasis was on length. Adapting this format to a certain kind of scholarly discourse that didn't appear before. The calendar is gone. The tyranny of the little post per day is gone. The focus is more on making this into a discussion platform. What you see arising at the same time as well, and this was encouraged by both Blogger and Movable Type, is right side blog roles where you could link to other people in your community. So there's a sense of who else is writing on literature in a digital age. So there's that. Movable Type introduces trackbacks at this time. And so you could, someone could write a long blog post, and you could write a long blog post answering that, and it would automatically track back to that other blog post so that you would have a feed of discussion going on. Again, interfaces enabling new kinds of genre. And here we've got already scholarly communities testing the boundaries of this. Just a very few people, mostly in literature, some in social sciences, some of the earliest bloggers in academia, actually very young, or grad students, many grad students. So Josh Marshall, who went on to create Talking Points Memo, who was a PhD student at Brown, left. Matt Iglesias. These are all now very big-time bloggers. We're all blogging here at the turn of the century. I'm trying to think of some other names, but these were people who started their blogs in school and went on to do other things, didn't see any reason for this kind of activity to exist in academia. From there, things move really rapidly, and we can talk about new platforms like WordPress, which are really critical. They're running a lot of what we do now in that they're even more flexible, right? They've got the ease of themes. There's a whole plugin directory and this notion of a plugin architecture that you can make a blog in almost any format that you want with any kind of widget that you want and behavior that you want. And so you see within, for instance, the plugin directory, different kinds of communities creating skins around the blogging, the basic blogging platform, to enable what they want to do. Plugin directory, yeah. So, you know, out of this, of course, then comes what I, you know, like to call the sort of Cambrian explosion of academic blogging, where you've gone from the early explorers and actually... Timothy Burke started just by writing an HTML page himself that he just kept updating, just one giant HTML page. What you see is then, because of these community efforts, community blogs, which I think are really fascinating, things like Frog in a Well, which is an Asian history blog. It's written in four different languages, English, Korean, Mandarin Chinese, and Japanese. and involves about a dozen scholars at multiple universities, again, enabled off of this new platform, slightly older, Crooked Timber, which tends to be oriented toward current events, but has a number of academics who are blogging it in long form, 500, 1,000, 2,000 words on the platform. Savage Minds, anthropologists who got together to work on again, a common scholarly platform that is underneath WordPress. At Mason, more recently, Steve Barnes, who's a scholar who studies the Soviet Gulag, has written a history of the Soviet Gulag. He set up a Russian history blog that has a half dozen scholars. And they're just experimenting with this form because they realize that they can have lengthy scholarly discussions in ways that you really couldn't have in a journal, which is very inert. They can respond to each other. They can comment on each other. I mean, all the interactivity that we expect from the web. And they can you can see in these places new formats. It's not just WordPress. Of course, Drupal runs things like Arcade at Stanford, their arts and humanities group blog, Niche Environmental History in Canada. So, you know, back to the Russian history blog. So what's interesting now, again, is this emergent behavior in these communities. Steve, who is not a very technical guy, he asked for my advice. I said, just get started and see what happens. And they've started to stumble, and I think this is important, on new genres. So here's one thing that they did that was incredibly successful, where a new and very important book came out about the Gulag, this autobiography, or memoir, called Gulag Boss, came out. Very important new book in their field. And what they did is each of the six of them wrote a long blog post independently. They also invited, I think, a half dozen other scholars who work on Soviet history to write as well. And they posted these sequentially on their blog. It created a real storm of interest in their field. There were a lot of comments on their blog posts. And, you know, it became a very vibrant scholarly communal site of discussion, far better than a 500-word review in a history journal. Right? It was something new. You got 12 takes on the original thing and then people debating it really live. And it was a very webby kind of moment, I think, not print. So a couple of our experiments on this, if you, again, continue to think about pushing the genre forward and thinking about what the advantages of the web are, right? We can begin again to layer more and more on top of it. You know, as scholarly work becomes more webby, I think the journal has to become more webby. If you look at the interface at something like Project Muse, not to disparage it, but what does it encourage? It encourages the production of PDFs, right? That's what you're encouraged to download. There's no commentary that you could put on the site, right? So the thought process that went into digital humanities now is, you know, we looked around the web and saw hundreds of digital humanities scholars openly writing or putting open projects on the web, and that there needn't be a reason in that kind of a world for someone to submit work to a journal. It is already out there. And again, this is what gets to this thinking about demand, supply and demand, right? We want to have an environment that encourages open publishing, but that also recognizes and highlights good work and disseminates that to the community to maintain community practices, community standards. And so what we try to do with this project is find the best that's being written, thought, and coded in digital humanities and highlight that in a stream of work. I could put up a very complex flowchart of how this works. I'll explain it much more simply in that we have a registry of people working in digital humanities. A lot of those people do have blogs. Maybe it's an unusual field in that way, although maybe it's unusual for now, but maybe it's common 10 years from now. We keep track of what those people are doing via RSS, So via this technology that automatically distributes in a push mechanism new content. So we have a listening post that listens for new work. We have other methods of radar, I would call radar, for finding good new digital humanities work. Some of it is from chatter on Twitter. We dissect what's going on Twitter and see what people are linking to a lot. Maybe it's not on a blog that we're already following or an institutional website that we're not following. We can find new work that way. We can set up alerts through various other systems, Google searches and those sorts of things, for new work. And we're tracking all kinds of institutional places as well, things like repositories for new works that's added. Once that happens, we can begin to aggregate that. We actually have a raw stream. And I think here's where you can think about how the web works. There's actually several different ways of reading digital humanities now. You can actually get the raw sort of, you know, I think what would be called by people at Twitter, the fire hose of all digital humanities work, if you'd like to go insane like me and the other editors, where you're looking at, you know, perhaps 100 posts a day and having to weed through that. Or you can start looking at filtered work as you go in what I've called a kind of pyramid or layers of review and dissemination as we go up. We have something now called Editor's Choice, which we pick out the one or two best things that we've seen from the day. And so you can subscribe just to those posts. In addition to, we have a news column, which is for things that are not original scholarships, so just calls for proposal, job listings, things that we think would aggregate an audience so that we would have demand for the high-quality original research that's in the left column, which is Editor's Choice. So we've thought a lot about, you know, it's one thing to just create a new open access journal, but it's very hard to get people to read it. So we're looking at building audience, and we're shamelessly marketing this. I'm doing that right now. So I'm shamelessly marketing this as the best one-stop shopping. If you're new to digital humanities or if you're old in digital humanities, it's the one place where you can go and find new work to read. So it acts, again, as a layer on top of the web to aggregate and curate and disseminate high-quality work. You don't need to submit anything. We find you. We know that you're out there. Eventually, this will turn into something that looks more like a standard journal, and that will have a quarterly version, which will be even harder to get into. So if maybe 1% of all works in digital humanities, new project launches, new code we've highlighted, new blog posts, if only 1 out of 100 of those things gets into the Editor's Choice, maybe 1 out of 10 of the things that make it into Editor's Choice, or even less, will make it into a quarterly journal that will produce an EPUB and disseminate, and there may even be a print version, because we know, again, based on narcissism, that people need credit lines on CVs and need sort of something more tangible. Digital Humanities Now is getting an ISSN number. We're getting an editorial board. So there'll be all the markers that we know we need to do that. And people can rightly say, you know, this 2,000-word blog post that got into the Q4, fourth quarter 2011 edition was 1 out of 1,000 that came across the transom through the various radar methods that Digital Humanities Now has. And so that's, I think, a much better ratio for saying this is something that's important and credited in the community. We're also looking at things like comments on blogs to see how, you know, it's not just us making a decision, it's the community making a decision about what's important and good. But it will be a marker of quality to make it to that final level. And so if you're starved for attention, or you have very little of it, you could just subscribe to the quarterly edition and just get a handful of pieces in the same way you would for a traditional journal. Okay, I won't dwell into this. I just added a couple slides during the day because people brought up Hacking the Academy, but Hacking the Academy was, in a sense, a test bed for this kind of process. We asked for submissions on ways to use digital media and technology to better the Academy, to in a sense, return it to some of the values it had. I will categorize this, and this is a self-criticism, as a be careful what you wish for project. The idea was we're trying to hack the edited volume which is, you know, normally done where I would, you know, write to 10 of my friends and say, you know, by 2015, could you get me an 8,000 word essay? And then 2015 would roll along and say, could you really get to me by 2017? And then we'd get there, and then, you know, I'd collate it together and we'd go through the editing process. Instead of that, we tried to, again, sit back and let the web come to us. It ended up that about 180 people submitted 330 pieces of all shapes and sizes. It was over 1 million words. I will say it was rather unpleasant to edit. this is an attempt at a self-criticism, right? This is part of the problem of the web, is just the mass of it, the sheer mass of it. And I think in digital humanities now, we're trying to do is set up earlier filters so we don't get overwhelmed like this. So Tom Scheinfeld and I, who co-edited it, spent months reading through these things. But I think we actually learned a lot from the process, which is, first of all, that notion that there are a lot of different genres out there. I mean, we found really good 500-word pieces, which, you know, you would never have. Even in something like Digital Humanities Quarterly, you couldn't have a 500-word piece, right? An editor would reject that. But we instead put it into little sections called voices or conversations where we tried to explore new kinds of genres, where instead of having, again, the 8,000-word footnoted piece, we could put together items of different shapes and sizes, and we just tried to listen to the genres that came to us, although sadly without audio and video for the print version because we couldn't figure out a way to do that. We tried to listen to what came to us and just chose the best 50 pieces and coordinated that and put them into the volume. So again, that'll be coming out from University of Michigan soon. They've got the e-edition is up. And what also enabled this was a culture of openness within digital humanities where every single one of the contributors was willing to do a Creative Commons license, attribution license, so we'll be sure to attribute it to them, but we didn't have to deal with all the funny business of getting copyrights and worrying about if we post this in other places, what will happen. As long as you have a CC BY license on it, everyone is credited, which after all is the narcissistic thing to do, right? People care about the credit. No one's getting any royalties from this. So we might as well say that it's out there on the web. It's getting you reputation, and that's what's important. I happen to think that this was torturous to do from the editorial side, but I think it's a model that could be repeated. Maybe not for everything, but I do like the idea of a, you know, state of the field volume, for instance. You know, it was the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. I would have loved to have seen a Hacking the Academy style volume on some thought pieces, spur of the moment, you know, 150th anniversary. What are people thinking? You know, not a James McPherson monumental kind of thing, but, you know, have the American Historical Association or some or publisher sit there and say, you know, submit whatever you want at any length, and we'll try to coordinate into sort of thought groups some new pieces. And I think it would actually work really well for that. So again, thinking about new platforms and what the web can produce in terms of generative new platforms and new genres, I think is critical. And I think, again, based upon a lot of what we've looked at the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media, what's going on here, and indeed work that we have done with the very people here, has produce this emphasis on things like platforms. So, you know, you look at something like Omeka, which is a platform that we've produced for mounting digital collections on the web using open standards. It is modeled on things like WordPress, where everything is modular, everything can be, it's extensible, it's very webby. We can pull things in using standards into a Omeka exhibit on the web. We can push things out from Omeka onto the web. We really try to emphasize, you know, communal delivery of a platform for scholarship. There's all kinds of documentation and getting involved. There are plugins. This is true also for other big open source projects. Otero has a lot of different plugins that we have not authorized. They were permissionless innovation. So we have there's a developer who really loves Android. He's created something called Zazzle, I think it is, which is Otero for Android phones that lets you enter stuff onto Android phones. He never let us know anything about it, that's great. Vaya con Dios. You know, best kind of collaboration where you don't even tell me about it. I don't need to know about it. Doesn't take up my time. Doesn't take up your time. Permissionless innovation. Theming as well and design, I think, is something that is, again, borrowed from this WordPress type model. You know, obviously, with our good friends here in the Scholars Lab, we've been able to do things like collaboration, where you know, getting together Omeka and Neatline and things that we, you know, at this at CHNM we weren't going to do, but we know there's really core strengths here in areas that we're not very good at, and so this kind of collaboration is really good, where we are talking to each other and know that we have different needs, but all everything fits together well in a really webby way. I wanted to sort of conclude with a discussion of this 21st century library. You know, I've been involved in these discussions about the DPLA. Jerry's on, you're on the board, right, of the DPLA. And I think it's a really interesting question of, you know, what something like a Digital Public Library of America is going to look like. And you won't be surprised that I return to these basic themes of platforms and interfaces and communities to think about them. You know, I think the big problem is that right now, for most humanities scholars, you know, this is the digital library of the 21st century, which is Google Books. As Steve mentioned, there are over 15 million volumes scanned right now. But we are beholden to the interface that they give us, and worse off, we are beholden to the APIs they give us, the application programming interfaces, which I've been constantly, if you read my blog, I've been like beating a dead horse here, the APIs, that is the sort of root level access, the programming level access to Google Books, is awful. And actually, Google, if you look carefully at their API documentation, has consistently made their APIs more and more, you know, they will say streamlined or easy to use, but less powerful. You know, I coded something really early on called the Syllabus Finder, the much lamented Syllabus Finder, which found syllabi on the web and analyzed them, did some text analysis on them. And I was using the original Google API, the API they had for their search engine. In fact, they really liked the Syllabus Finder early on. They gave me all these like free credits to use it as much as I wanted. And so I was able to like grab a lot of stuff out of their cache of web pages to analyze. And then one day they said, oh, well, we're deprecating this API. We're bringing out this new API for the search engine. And that new API basically enabled you to embed a Google search in your web page, right? They took total control of it back, and that's when the Syllabus Finder died. The Google Books API did the same thing. What'd they come out with? You can embed a Google book in your blog post, right? Well, that's all, you know, that's fine, but it carves out or it excludes a whole kind of scholarship that we want to get. I was more hopeful that their Books API, which is in this weird kind of beta, and it looked like they just had an intern working on it for a long time, which is what I often think of some Google properties, that they just have, you know, one summer intern working on these things. And indeed, they had that for the annotation tool for Google Books. It was written by an intern one summer. I don't know if anyone has used it, but their main API basically just allows you to link up with what's called their My Library feature, where you can see what books are in someone's open bookshelf or private bookshelf. You can add to it. You can search, yes, you can do these things, but you can't extract anything in terms of a research corpus that Steve and others would like to work with. It is very much walled off. And especially now that they've got, if you go to when they changed the books.google.com homepage to be half about their scanned books and half about their bookstore, you can see that, you know, we shouldn't like hold our breath for some kind of true access to this 21st century library. So, you know, I think we have to put our hopes on something new and open and webby. And thinking about the DPLA is I think, important. You know, I have been worried that sort of nothing will happen because I think this is an expensive project. I think, you know, it got a $5 million grant from the Arcadia Fund and from the Sloan Foundation a couple of weeks ago. But if you know about how much it costs to do something like this, you know, $5 million is really a drop in the bucket. Europeana, which is the European aggregation of cultural heritage items, website, europeana.eu, is a $1 billion project, right? Now it's not going to have $1 billion. Maybe it will be funded in lira or kwatlus or some other new type. But this is something very expensive, but I think it is something very important, again, to make our own tools, to make our own interfaces, to think about how a library could be a generative platform for new kinds of scholarship, I think is really critical. The DPLA ran a beta sprint of, show us what the DPLA will look like. And I say this is these are not, by the way, these comments I'm about to say are not disparaging comments. They're more of, what will it look like is maybe getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. Here's one thing, which it is really neat, this shelf life project that comes from David Weinberger and others at the Harvard Library Lab. That shows a bookshelf, so trying to get back to this notion of a bookshelf and how you might be able to browse a bookshelf. I'm not sure that School Morphs is a good way to go for a digital public library in America, but this is one kind of interface that was shown. There's another one from the Smithsonian and other federal agencies that was more of a museum-y browsing experience. And then also from Harvard at MetaLab, the Extramuros, which had all kinds of very complicated, high-level sort of bird's-eye view, data mining views of the collection so that you could kind of sort through it and arrange things and was more interactive. Again, I think this is putting the cart before the horse here. I think the best thing that's happened is the underlying work that's going on, often in places that are not going to get as recognized, like the technical working group. And this is where I got this notion of a generative platform from Ed Summers, who pointed this out, that in this little working group that happened in May, they had this conclusion that the DPLA should act as a generative platform for undefined future uses. This is exactly, I think, the route that it should be going in, that it is, in a sense, thinking first about what's underneath it that will enable things like Extramuros. I think Extramuros is really cool. I would love to have that. I'd love to have Zotero run on top of the Digital Public Library of America and interact with it. I'd love to have Shelf Life interact with it. But at its base, right, the nitty-gritty of it, there would have to be some kind of platform. And that's where I think there's the real interesting things are going on now that seem a lot, if you're in the library world or the tech world, it seems like, this inside baseball kind of stuff, but it's really, really critical to get right to enable the work to go on. That's why I'm most interested in things like Mint, which was shown, it's used by Europeana to standardize metadata so that the metadata is interoperable. So, you have these horrible metadata issues when you're trying to combine collections. And I think these things that are behind the scenes, but that normalize data so you could have tens of thousands of collections across America all be aggregated, I think is a fascinating way to go. Richard Urban, I'll give a shout out to him, who did the behind the scenes RDF work for one of the beta sprints. I mean, this is the real work, right? I mean, it's the initial foundational work. It's like the work that happened here and at IAP, right? I mean, 20 years ago, of getting the XML right, getting the databases right, is still going on here, so that then you could think about what the search interfaces are, what is enabled underneath. So there's, all this ugly, there's a huge 7 megabyte, maybe larger than that, file of RDF that was used to create this, right? One interface here, this is the DLF entry, where they've, and the key thing here isn't the web design or the colors they've used or anything like that, but just the fact that they were able to, through a common RDF, aggregate a million objects and make them searchable in many different facets, right? And then in turn, in this very giving, sharing, webby way, make the underlying data available so that then you could build something on top of that. So if I'm interested in the Salem Witch Trials, I can extract a slice of this database in an ad hoc way, right, permissionless way, and do something with it. Combine it with what's going on here to create some other new kind of work. Right. So I return to these things as openness and standards producing generative platforms, and the interfaces, right, which are coming next to shape the genres, right? That we start with this foundation, the technical foundation, move to interfaces shaping different genres. Extramuros is gonna shape one kind of genre. It's got a kind of scrapbooky, scholarly feel where it's scholarship as collage and annotation. But there might be other kinds of things, scholarly works that will be based upon it, some of them looking very traditional. And then communities defining practice. I really like to emphasize here, when I think about these points, I'll give a final thanks to the Nines Project, which I think does this extremely well. It's aggregated scholarly resources in a way that is very, very powerful. And especially when I click on, you know, the communities tab, the fact that there are these different communities, and now, of course, it's spawned a franchise, you've got 18th Connect and these other things, the fact that the communities can come in and curate their own data, right, begin to annotate it, et cetera, get credited for high-quality aggregation and curation, and build scholarship on top of that. I think this is a great example of scholars taking control of their own tools, right, shaping it for the kinds of things they want to do, and in a sense, interoperating and creating as communities. So I'll stop there. I'd love to have an open discussion. I look for any comments Jerry might have.
I agree with all of that. Dan's approach to, or his idea about how EBLI also, I didn't intend to start with EBLI, but I think I have to say something about it. I entirely agree with that approach to the development of the technical aspects of EBLI. And I'm actually quite sanguine that this is the way it's going to go. I'm also pretty sanguine about the money. From the beginning, the steering committee has been pretty well aware that this thing is going to cost $800,000 or $900,000. $1 billion, excuse me. Nobody seems to be intimidated by this. The $5 million that was acquired a couple of weeks ago, it is just to get things going for the next 18 months. And the plan is actually to roll out the first installment of it in June of 2013. And even though that seems very, very ambitious, I think actually the ambitiousness of it is what energizes it and will drive. So you should keep an eye out for this, because it's an incredible event. From my point of view, as an educator, as a scholar, probably the greatest event I've ever seen in my life. And so I'm full of enthusiasm for it. Now, to talk about what Dan was describing in the past, present, and future of digital humanities, and I would want to say, actually, just humanities education in a world where digital technology and digital resources of various kinds have emerged. Digital humanities is a special thing, and I'm much, much less involved with it or learned about it than Beth or than Dan is. I'm much more involved in far more traditional things, and in fact, I started to get try to make myself into an Americanist about 2 years ago. What I'm most concerned about is really the traditional institution. Not so much what Dan was describing over the past, say, 20 years, which is the period of time I've been involved with this. It is true, over the past 20 years, the explosion of people, or what Dan calls communities, different kinds of communities, their involvement with these kinds of resources has been remarkable. But if you go, if I go, if you go, anybody goes, to the institutions that I work in and that we're all part of, and you go to the individual humanities departments to find out what people are doing in a digital way, Dan's early graph up there is about the dismal truth of the matter. Almost nobody in the traditional disciplines is actively involved in these matters. And if you reflect on the development of digital humanities, or as I do, over the past 20 years, it's not without reason, for example, that IAF became successful as it did, especially for its first 10 years. It was an amazing example of how you could get a lot done, but you had to make a certain move. You had to get it out of the academic programs. You had to actually make sure that the director of IAF and all the programs of IAF were not going to answer to the dean's office or therefore to the departments. They were going to answer to the provost. And so it sort of shifted slightly away from the absolute center of what we do in an institution like UVA or any other institution in Maryland, George Mason, wherever it might be. And so we were given a lot of, Dan calls it permissionless. We had a lot of permissionlessness in IAF. I said permissioning because it would be my preferred word. What I would like to see developed is an environment that was strongly permissioning, not so much permissionless. May be able to talk about that in a minute. Anyhow, that's the past, as I see it. The IAF, MIT, Nebraska, A&M, there are all these institutional developments have taken place within the traditional higher educational institutions. And at the same time, outside, extramurally, all kinds of other things are happening, and increasingly some of the most exciting and most interesting things are happening. But when you look inside the institutions, not much really has changed between 1992 and now. Yes, there's a certain amount of change, but not much. I don't want to go on too long about this, but I want to make one key point. Because so much has changed, mostly extramurally, in the last 20 years, I think we are in a much different situation. The DPLA is really an index of it, or a symptom of the difference of the situation that we're in right now. The past and the present are what they are. Everybody can see them, both within and without the institution. So what is the future? From my point of view, there will not be important and significant change in higher education until the programs change. If you think about, for example, the degree in my home department in English, we in the English department over the past 20 years have put out all kinds of incredibly important people. Beth is sitting there, BC is sitting there, I look around, I think of other people, but when I think about what I'm most really proud of in my involvement with this is the people that I have seen come out of the work that we've been doing. Not so much the things that have been made. And we have actually turned out an awful lot of wonderful people. But they did not come from our program. They had to come from outside the program. So if there will be a significant change in the future in terms of digital humanities education, it is going to have to take into account the sort of thing that another person who came from here, Steve, I was talking to him briefly earlier. Steve actually teaches within the English department humanities students in different departments, including the English department, how to program it. To me, has got to happen. If within the educational institution, we are actually going to make a big difference.
the last thing I want to say is I talked sort of upbeat about the DPLA and my hopes for digital humanities and digital education in the most broad sense. And I am very upbeat about it. I have to say, I'm not upbeat about the hopes for changing this institution that we're in or any other institution. The higher education institution is incredibly suffocating. And how you break through these forms that it has developed for itself over hundreds of years, I confess, I do not know. But I do believe that the sorts of things that Dan is doing, that lots of other young people are doing, basically slightly aside from the basic programmatic mission of the university, will eventually actually make a difference. But right now, and in the near future, I doubt. And I actually would like to hear if any of you out there have some thoughts about how to bring change within this institution. I would be thrilled to know about it. When I go out to talk about these things, the places where I get the most interesting conversation are in community colleges, small state colleges, colleges. But if you want to go to Princeton, or you want to go to Yale, or you want to go, well, Harvard is a little special case, but even there, if you go into the departments, you're not going to get a very interesting conversation about this matter. You have to get away from those places. And in fact, some of the best conversation will happen in a place like this, or at Scholars Lab. Where is Scholars Lab? Scholars Lab is in the library. It is extra programmatic. It's one of the most lively places for digital humanities I have ever seen. But it is extra programmatic. So that
most permissioning license we can get. And indeed, we're hoping to get that back upstream as people, as DH now really gets rolling, is that even adding the non-commercial bit to it is problematic. If University of Michigan sells for $25 a year a print edition, is that commercial? Is it not commercial? Money's a lower. So, you know, I think just a straight Creative Commons attribution license, CC BY 3.0 license, is the way to go for scholarship. I mean, if you want to spread it far and wide, that's great. I mean, if someone wants to take, and people have already done this, take some of the content of Hacking Academy that was brought up earlier and reshape it, great. I mean, it just gives us further dissemination for our views. They don't have to ask us about it. Get into an argument about what's commercial or not commercial. They can take this up.
More serious question is a little bit about the standards, open standards on the platform. I was just thinking about an example with the API and Google. So they're writing a standard. They will suggest it's a simpler, better standard because it allows more, but then it comes in and prohibits all sorts of things.
Right.
Ways that might be ameliorated in trying to think about standards. I'll think about standards so that they don't have quite that kind of problem.
Right. Well, I mean, again, I think, and this is where I think the work of the DLF, Illinois, many partners, I've forgotten a couple of them, but you know, they made also just a straight data dump available. API lists, right? I mean, eventually you could run your own instance of it. You don't need to rely on them listening for API calls or anything like that. So it's something brought up earlier. you know, he's really in favor of just really simple, RESTful APIs. Really, really simple. We've done that with Zotero, where it's just incredibly simple. You want all the items in a group, it's just Zotero.org/group/the name of the group. You call that, you'll get return something that a payload that's exactly what you're looking for. So we're not making it more complicated than it needs to be. So I think just these most basic levels of these things. I mean, in some sense, the Google API is both too complex and too myopic, right? It's got a lot of bells and whistles, but it doesn't give you the basic access that you want. And that's what the web does well. In some sense, it's really, really basic. It's almost underwritten compared to other forms of modern language. So, but I think that's one of its advantages.
I want to make two very brief comments. The first on the Hacking Academy, it struck me when I submitted a piece to Hacking Academy, I opened up my email and sent you a link, and I was done. And I contrast that with when I publish in a scholarly journal. And they come back and they say, first of all, they say, you know, could you take this and make it look like you typed it on an IBM Selectric in 1963? And then send it off to us, and then a couple of years, I mean, just, yeah.
Right.
The other comment I wanted to make was about DHNOW, and this maybe speaks to Jerry's concern about the revolution within. And that's that, you know, I remember very clearly the moment when I realized that I was a lot more thrilled, a lot more excited to see my work on digital humanities now than to see it come out in print. And that's extraordinary because my department understands print journal article publishing perfectly well. And the calculation I was making really is that, yes, but this thing on digital humanities now is actually going to get read. And so, weighing the balance, is it better for me to impress the 5 members of my merit review committee, or is it better to have, and I can see being a narcissist, I can see the web status, having 1,000 readers, and I myself said, I'd rather have the readers, but in the long run, that's better. That sounds like a seeds for a revolution to me, because when you finally say to yourself, I'm better off professionally to be on DHNOW than I am on this other thing. That sounds to me like a mansion. And maybe I'm playing this totally wrong, but I don't think I am.
Nothing new.
I think, well,
not for you. But what about the other 55 people?
Well, but maybe so, but I wonder, I mean, is that, if I'm right, then why, you know, is it so hard to imagine that others catch on to that? Because, you know, it's better for my career to put it under CC BY, throw it out there, and get 1,000 readers and tickets. See what I'm saying?
I don't know how many graduate students we have, but let's say we take in about 14 of them a year, and so we run the graduate students for year after year after year. So 10 years, that's 140 graduate students that we run through. They are being trained not to think the way you think. Their entire program is designed to think differently. And so all you're doing is shooting out hundreds of graduate students into the departments, and you're replicating this model over and over again. So when you said that you get a thrill out of, publishing in a...
Not just a thrill, but real professional benefit.
Indeed. But you're a programmer.
Well, no. I mean, I write articles, I write normal essays, six things. But again, I say it is better not to sell the copyright. It is better not to deal with a publisher. It is better not to. I mean, this is heresy.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, that's the essay. I love you very much, but don't take this wrong. That's a narcissistic way of thinking.
Of course it is. Okay. But that's exactly the thing.
The demand side of the equation is much more interesting, right? I mean, I think, you know, there's things like, and this is not a criticism, but there are other platforms like the Open Journal System where it's very easy to set up a PDF distribution system. But that's not what we're going for, right? We're going for
audience creation system where if we aggregate enough audience that's paying attention to you, then more people like you will want to be in that, right? And we're going to bootstrap up from that point rather than from the point of you send us a 8,000-word Word document uploaded here, right? You know, I think just back, just a quick gloss on your first comment about, you know, you just sent us a link for Hacking Academy. I think we'll have to make, and this will be another tough transition that we did not have a lot of colleagues, and I get in a lot of arguments with my colleagues about this, who ask me, you know, well, on the sustainability model, who's going to pay for the Linelander? And, you know, the footnote, like, who's going to correct all the footnotes? And, you know, my point is, well, we're going to have to cast off some things along the way. We cannot just maintain the model, right? I think the case of daily newspapers in this country is a good example of that. Like, you can't just ignore it and assume that the model will continue on and the same revenue streams will be there. You'll have to think about new models that effectively do what you want to do, transmit news, get across scholarship, will have a different cost structure. And I actually think, you know, it's okay if there's a typo in your Hacking the Academy. Like, I'm willing to sacrifice the cost that it would take to, although I did actually thoroughly bend your Tom and I did do a lot of typo correction, but I wouldn't be willing, you know, if someone said, oh, but look how long that took you. I think we have to be less perfectionistic. I mean, we gain a lot from that if we were to just step back and say, what are the hidden costs of scholarship, right? And there's lots of hidden costs of the current system. We just don't realize it. We see all the advantages are really obvious to our narcissistic brains. We don't see all the hidden costs. And if you explain all the hidden costs that are there, then you can begin to talk about how a different system that might be open. It might have different features, but it would have these advantages, and that's how we approach it.
Andy, you've got your hand up.
Just for Jerry, and actually for all of us, to sort of follow up on the point about integrating this digital advantage board into the programmatic structures. As I listen to that, I mean, I think first of curricular integrations, and that's sort of what you pointed to with Steve's course on programming. But are there other levers or other things that you're thinking of when you say that besides just altering the curricular requirements and say graduate training? Hiring, are you thinking of centers like this one? Maybe that's just the problem. What levers do we have to sort of move digital work closer into the organization?
Make it in the interest, or try to make it in the interest of the departments to do it. So, our provost, find the money to create a dozen fellowships for graduate students in any ANS department, with the understanding they'll be given that department will be given that fellowship for that graduate student if that graduate student is going to be doing some kind of a graduate degree with a serious digital development. The department would run out of that, and they would see that they were able, in fact, to support and help them do the work that they should do. I mean, it's a small thing, but I actually think it would make a huge difference, within a reasonable time, 10 years or something.
But it's something commercial that's happening with scholars that now, so how would it be different if it was occurring?
Because the program would have to adapt itself to the student. I mean, it happens outside, of course. Nine's dozen, the scholars nine dozen, we have lots of resources for resourceful students who want to work outside of the programs. But we don't have that equivalent thing within the programmatic structure.
And I was going to ask if I can just jump in, why that matters. And it's because you think we need to convert the
entire
community.
We need to change the graduate programs.
Undergraduate.
Bachelor.
Yeah.
Can I just say, I mean, as somebody who's many of us are actually looking at the job list, it's not that there aren't departments that want people to do these things. It's that they're not sure what they want, and they're not sure how to authorize it for frequently. I mean, that's what I think it's really important to have some kind of print version of what you're doing. I actually talked with your graduate students yesterday about it. They had that sort of Google Circle meetup on how this would look. But I mean, the authorizing function of it is in print. We can put it down. We can talk to senior colleagues. Another important point: do we have interlocutors in those colloquia when you do the sort of intermediate peer review stuff that you're thinking about doing? Do you have interlocutors that are not just in this conversation already, that are outside, you know, that have, when we have these sort of conversations about theory versus DH, I mean, people are raising really legitimate questions, right, that never get into these, that sometimes have a tendency not to get into the conversation because they feel self-excluded from the beginning with the tools we're building. So I mean, that's, I think it's really important to find ways to include colleagues and your colleagues that don't automatically use the tools from the beginning. That would be really helpful. But I think that there's lots of jobs that are, I completely agree with Professor McGann exactly on the description of how the department works. And I think the job market is trying to feel its way towards something else.
Well, I just wanted to, I know it's not you who makes the distinction between the cathedral and the bazaar, but it strikes me that the cathedral is not the problematic model. In fact, that's not been what we've been doing, because the cathedral was pre-byline. There was no personal credit for the cathedral. The cathedral grows out of a community aggregation over centuries, as I'm sure someone knows this. But it's I don't quite agree with you that perfectionism is the problem that humanities needs to get over in order for it to be doing the exciting things that you're showing can be done with, sort of digitized and kind of collaborative and open sourced and creative commons style of producing scholarship.
Yeah, I didn't talk about it long enough probably to explain it, but it had maybe less to do with attribution than this notion of like the perfectly crafted complete whole versus something that, as Eric Raymond points out, open source software, you see it from point 0.01 version, which like doesn't run in this version here, and you can follow it all the way through, right?
You see how you see the scale.
Right. And the same way on the blogs, like Steve and I have argued, I think quite viciously on our blogs against each other and our views on different things, and you can see our evolving thoughts, which I think academics don't like to show the thought process at all. Like we would destroy our whole word box if we could, and just leave the final product as and somehow we'd be embarrassed by this thing. So I think
can you tie it into the first talk this morning about thinking about could the universities be creating something more like our Libra as a way to sort of do our preprint. I think some of our colleagues might be receptive to the idea that, your conference papers and your other materials can be there with kind of proper framing.
Right. Well, I think that there again, that's the digital humanities now model is, maybe you could highlight stuff that, what's interesting about IRs, institutional repositories, is there are papers that are sleeper hits. That's very common, actually, in history. It's not the ones that are featured in the American Historical Review, but something in another journal that over 20 years people realize was something very important. And I think in the same way, if we can find things that are of interest, general interest, not just download metrics and things like that, but a homepage that looks more like, let's say with Stanford's Univ Arcade, where it's highlighting important new work from across the academy. I think some marketing would help on the demand side. If you knew that a paper that you put in the IR that was well received 3 or 5 years later, we get more prominence from the university as well. Or make it into, we have some other Press Forward, which is the umbrella project that is producing digital humanities now. We have other ones, for instance, in American history, where we're trying to, for instance, have genres where we revisit older materials. Right, and see how well has a book from 20 years ago stood up and tried to experiment with new kinds of genres. You can imagine things like that for IR materials.
So it is after 5, and if the magic of UVA catering has worked, behind that wall is some rather meager offering, which does not include any town hall report. So I gesture towards it more as a place where conversation could continue in a more informal manner, not because of the sustenance you'll find there, except intellectual sustenance, of course. And I'd like to thank, finally, Dana.
Oh, I just want to be grateful before everyone adjourns, because I thought this might be a really good moment to say that coming out of our Institute on Evaluating Digital Scholarship at NIMES, if you're interested or want to comment more on how to change departmental cultures, we actually have a document up in Common Press called Recommendations for Chairs, and I would love to be able to bring this conversation to that site, because it will be used when we go into our next, our summer 2012 Institute, in which we'll have a
partial
chair there. So it's
put that plug
on
the institutes.nimes.org.
Yes.
So a closing round of applause, please, for